time once again for Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have back with us live in the studios once again, Arun Gupta. Arun Gupta is co-founder of the Independent, Indy with I-N-D-Y, Pendant, and the Occupied Wall Street Journal. And we're going to be actually covering a wide variety of subjects this morning, kind of with the theme of democracy and war. Arun, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me back, Mike.
So you were in town today doing helping with a reading later this afternoon at 3 o'clock.
A talk and a reading at Elliott Bay Book Company at 3 p.m. Today. I'll be appearing with Michael Gold-Wartofsky, who's the author of The Occupiers, and he'll be doing a reading from the book. Really just a wonderful book, probably the best book written about the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I'll also be giving a short talk talking about really understanding what Occupy Wall Street was about and its political legacy that I argue is still very relevant today, that we see in things from like Black Lives Matter to the Fight for 15 Low Wage campaign to Shama Sawant to Bernie Sanders to the climate justice movement. And I think, you know, as we'll get into in a way, not so much that it's a result, but it's linked to what's even going on in Paris, this issue of popular democracy versus warfare. You know, Occupy Wall Street was a direct outgrowth of the Arab Spring, and what is going on in Paris is also directly related to how that all turned out now with these horrific attacks.
Everything is connected. You were also here just a couple of weeks ago covering our local elections.
Yes, I was here on election night looking at Shama Sawant's campaign. You know, this was of national, international significance as the only socialist serving in a major city in the United States, and whether or not she could get reelected when you had the whole business and political class really arrayed against her. And she beat him, you know, Shama Sawant and Socialist Alternative and all the people who back her, people who represent, she handily won against basically a nothing candidate, Pamela Banks, who had no credentials, no base, but managed to get huge amounts of support, all the establishment support from major media, you know, in just kind of a completely ridiculous step, I think, just showing how corrupt local politics are everywhere, how corrupted they are by the corporate state. The fact that 6 of the 9 city council members endorsed Pamela Banks, you know, when traditionally you're never supposed to weigh in on the races against an incumbent. But there's such tools of the corporate class that they endorse this cynical candidate who is running against Shama Sawant, someone who, whatever criticisms you want to make of her, she's shown that she can deliver the goods.
So do you see that as laying the groundwork for further city-oriented local candidates who have a socialist leaning winning elsewhere in the country?
I think it would be great if it would happen. It's hard. You know, there have been a few instances in recent years where other candidates with a distinct left bent have won. The Richmond Progressive Alliance in Richmond, California, that's in the Bay Area, a city that is essentially controlled by Chevron. They were able to beat the Chevron. There's a massive oil refinery there. And this Richmond Progressive Alliance organized for many years and was able to win the mayorship and I think a majority on the city council last year, and they were outspent like something like 70-1 by Chevron. Then Jackson, Mississippi, and the Malcolm X grassroots movement that was able to elect Chokwe Lumumba a couple of years ago, and then he tragically died of a heart attack last year while in office. But, you know, that was the culmination of a lot of great on-the-ground organizing. Then there's the Vermont, I think, Progressive Party that has also elected a number of folks to the state legislature. So there are these bright spots, and I think I've been someone for a long time who's been very critical and dismissive of trying to get into electoral politics, at least at the national level. But I think given these examples and that you can start to make a real difference, and you can do types of movement building, I think, clearly through electoral politics. I think there are other forms of movement building that are also very important. I also covered the Seattle teacher strike, and that's been following on various other kind of left efforts within workers' movements. You know, there was the Chicago teachers strike back in 2012. There was almost a strike last year in Portland where the Portland teachers were able to really organize and beat this concessionary contract, and the school board had to completely buckle. In Los Angeles, a reform, a left reform slate won a majority of won the leadership of the union there, I think, in the LA Unified District. So there are a lot of positive developments in terms of, you know, I think the principal left forces winning either in the workplace or the electoral level. And it would be great to see more efforts in terms of electoral politics, but it's certainly not easy. You know, you can run a candidate and that's hard enough, but to be able to run a campaign that actually has a serious shot of winning takes a lot of resources, takes a lot of discipline, you have to have a really good organization and strategy and leadership and really think things through. Because electoral politics it's a unique beast in terms of politically how you have to respond through the media, how you have to stay on your talking points, and frankly, you also need sharp, charismatic candidates, whatever your politics. And that's the thing about Shama Sawant, that she's incredibly quick on her feet and she's very charismatic. She has genuine personal appeal.
So, speaking of national electoral politics, what's your take on the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Bernie Sanders is, just like Shama Sawant clearly comes out of Occupy Wall Street. That's where she first came to prominence. And also the whole, a lot of people don't know this, even in Seattle. She was the one who first raised the $15 an hour minimum wage issue when she ran for state legislature. The state legislature back in 2012, before the low-wage workers movement publicly began. Bernie Sanders is also he would have never have gotten this far without Occupy Wall Street. He's clearly building on that energy, the way that Occupy shifted the debate from economic austerity to economic inequality. I think he says a lot of really great things on a lot of domestic issues, but the fact that he's running in the Democratic Party, it's like, look, we have one party in this country, Wall Street, with two wings. The Democratic Party is as completely implicated in the financial crash, completely implicated in the American-led project of capitalist globalization, right? You know, NAFTA passed under Clinton, TPP passes under Obama. Obama expended huge amounts of political capital to make sure that the fast tracking that's making the TPP possible passed, and yet he never exerted anywhere, you know, not even like a shred of this energy or political capital for, say, unions, right? You know, in terms of what their agenda was. So it really shows who is calling the shots, Wall Street and the national security state. So when Bernie Sanders says he'll support whoever is, quote, the eventual nominee, we know who that's going to be, Hillary Clinton. You know, no matter how much you may have hopes that Bernie Sanders is going to win, Hillary Clinton, the game is rigged. I mean, the Democrats aren't dumb. They're not going to let democracy exist in their party. It's completely rigged with the superdelegates, the vast majority of which, Hillary Clinton already has locked up. She has the resources to run a 50-state campaign, whereas Bernie Sanders is going to run into the brick wall of Super Tuesday. This is in early March of 2016, when 10 states that are heavily weighted towards the South where his support is the weakest. You have African-American and conservative white voters who will favor the Clintons. You know, when Hillary's running, it's not just her running, of course. She will unleash Bill at some point, and he's going to herd huge amounts of the more conservative Democratic voters as well as African-Americans back into the hold. You know, he's also much of a scallywag that Bill Clinton is, he is also one of the most charismatic politicians on the landscape. So the deck is very much stacked against Bernie Sanders. But I think there's also a deeper problem. And this was, I think, one of the really just big weaknesses of Occupy Wall Street, this kind of blinkered focus on domestic policies. You know, the economic crash was a global economic crash. All sorts of other countries were affected, you know, especially throughout Europe, Latin America, Africa, Asia, by Wall Street taking down the economy. But Occupy, unfortunately, had this kind of obsessive focus on the domestic front, which is understandable, you know, because the crash just spread just tremendous pain and suffering in the American social landscape. The foreclosures, the unemployment, people losing their health care, the huge increases in debt that's been going on and has accelerated since Occupy Wall Street. But, you know, I use a term which some intellectuals do, that it's the American-led project of capitalist globalization. That, you know, when we talk about finance and economics, where you can't talk about this ship of the United States being apart from everything else. We're the leader, and we're also completely interconnected with the global economy. And part of this blinkered focus, you know, this narrow focus, the problem with it is also just the complete elision of a foreign policy that we, you know, it's just like we don't talk about foreign policy. And so, like, I've heard many people, many Bernie Sanders supporter heard or seen them say, like, oh, well, you know, if you point out that Bernie Sanders has really terrible foreign policy records, he supports drones, he supported Kosovo bombing, he is a 100% backer of Israel, he calls for, you know, continuing the war against ISIS, which means continuing the war against terror, people be like, well, okay, you know, but that's a side issue. And it's just like, really? 94% of humanity is a side issue. You can't separate the imperial state from the capitalist state. And, you know, we see this, I think, most tragically with what is going on in Paris. You know, before the Arab Spring, the previous incarnations of ISIS, you know, first was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, then Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, had effectively been isolated by a number of factors, one of which is, first of all, they took root because of the U.S. They were created as a result of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But eventually they were isolated. They had kind of alienated a lot of Sunnis. And the U.S. also, one of the few things it did that was intelligent was put a lot of Sunni tribes on the payroll. So that got them from – that's what really led to the decline in the insurgency in starting in 2007. And so Al-Qaeda in Iraq was really isolated. But they got a base again because of the Syrian civil war. And, you know, the Syrian civil war, there's multiple causes, but certainly one of the biggest factors was the Arab Spring. It started just a couple of months after, or really weeks after Mubarak was toppled in January of 2011. And so that's where it was able to really get the base of operations and it spread. And I think, you know, for the West, that they prefer these, they vastly prefer these like savage medieval fundamentalist movements than they prefer secular democratic popular movements. You know, we've seen this time and again. The Muslim Brotherhood was backed by British intelligence and the CIA for decades as to undermine the secular left in the Middle East. You know, we should remember that historically the left, the communist left, socialist left, was incredibly powerful throughout the Arab world for most of the 20th century. But the U.S. wanted to undermine it, and they turned to religious fundamentalists. Israel had a direct hand in the rise of Hamas because they wanted that as a counterweight to the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization, which was a secular nationalist left movement. And so, you know, what we've seen with the Arab Spring, you know, particularly what happened in Egypt, what happened in Libya, that the U.S. is fine being in bed with just these sadistic, savage movements that are really inflict just horrible suffering on the people in conjunction with the horrible suffering, the bombing, and the wars we inflict upon them. And I think, you know, these Paris attacks are certainly play into the West's hands. It's two sides of the same coin. And you know, what's really tragic is we know the script completely about what's going to happen. France is already like, you know, this means war. There's going to be massive increase in racial profiling. Don't be surprised if in the next few days or weeks you see attacks on Muslims in France, mobs, individuals attacking Muslims. Don't be surprised if trigger-happy security forces kill brown people because they're profiling them. This happened in London after the two bombings. I think those were, what, 2005? And, you know, so you're going to see like kind of this suppression of democracy and especially this very racialized suppression of democracy in France in the name of the security state that we need to protect people. And I'm not downplaying what happened in France, but, you know, this is happening all the time in the Middle East and to the point that we don't even notice it anymore. There were suicide bombings in Beirut. This just happened a couple of days ago that killed scores. Before that, there was ISIS took claim for the downing, or it's believed it's behind the downing of the Russian airliner that took off from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt that killed twice as many people. But, you know, it's just like, oh, well, you know, it's the Russians, it's the Arabs, so who cares? Somehow we only care if it happens to other, like, wealthy white Westerners. And yes, that is a tragedy. It's horrific. No one deserves to die the way that people died in France. But I think one of the important lessons, you know, and we can, I think, say coming out of Occupy Wall Street is sympathize with the people, not the nation. France is just this brutal colonial power that has tormented Africa for well over 100 years, just engaging in all these horrific wars, you know, that have bordered on quasi-genocide at time, killing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And so the state is not at all blameless. The state deserves none of our sympathy. And all these, you know, comments about this is attack on our common humanity. Well, you know, who was saying that when Iraq was being bombed back to the Stone Age? Who was saying that when, you know, we watched for months as defenseless Palestinians were slaughtered in Gaza? You know, who was saying that when the NATO war, by their own admission, the British Foreign Office admitted killed something like 20,000 civilians? You know, we supposedly went in to protect civilians, and then we killed many thousands of civilians in the name of protecting the civilians. And, you know, we can go on and on and on. Afghanistan, Pakistan, what's going on in Yemen right now is horrifying. The coup we backed in Bahrain, you know, we certainly didn't cause the civil war in Syria, but we have stoked it every step of the way.
Yeah, and I understand there's 6 million Muslims in France that are potentially going to be taking the brunt of what happened yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think just one of the grotesque phenomena when these attacks happen is, you know, Muslims rush to condemn the attacks, and yet whenever the West engages in its much worse brutalities. We don't see like Christian leaders around the world like having to feel like they need to rush to condemn the West's terrorism, state terrorism. You know, I think that's very important to make that distinction as well. Yeah, we certainly what happened in Paris is terrorism in terms of trying to terrify an entire people, but it just pales in comparison to state-led terrorism. And as a response to this kind of like retail terrorism, you know, we'll see wholesale terrorism visit upon the Middle East, and we'll also see a kind of terror and climate of fear visited upon Muslim and Arab people in France and North African people.
And with the Paris climate talks just like 2 weeks away, boy, that's going to be ratcheting things up there.
Yeah, and you know, I think I was really thinking about this, like one of the interesting things, again, about Occupy Wall Street is the idea that the center no longer holds, right? You know, like if we see Bernie Sanders as an outgrowth of Occupy Wall Street, you know, I think in a way Donald Trump is the flip side of that coin, that the people who are responding to him are responding to the same kind of like economic and social crises that people in Occupy Wall Street were responding to, just like Tea Party was kind of a particular racialized nativist response, a racist response. And so, you know, when the center doesn't hold, the extremes get more extreme. And we know that is very much the operating mechanism of climate change, that it's not that the planet just suddenly all heats up in one direction. No, the extremes get more extreme. You're seeing more extreme winters in the Northeast. And, you know, I'm not a resident of the Pacific Northwest, but the rains here, I've been here for like a couple of weeks, and the rains here are insane. You know, this seems like kind of highly unusual, and I know that the region was going through a drought up through the summer. And so as the climate gets more extreme, it's also the political landscape is getting more extreme as well, and they kind of march in lockstep. And I really feel like one of the victims of the Paris bombings, and again, I think the kind of the capitalist states in the West are going to be clearly happy about this, are the climate talks. You know, there were plans for very large demonstrations and protests, and you know, I know people who were like talking there might have been like big civil disobedience. That is going to be very extremely hard to pull off now. It's going to be, you know, we're going to hear it's too soon, that, you know, people have to have respect, you know, especially a lot of people are coming from around the world and, you know, this isn't their city. They can't do this. And so the capitalist state will be using the attacks to suppress these popular movements, these democratic movements. And yet the reality is the only way to address what is happening in the Middle East in terms of the rise of these vicious movements like ISIS is not through more war. You know, it's just like maybe if the U.S. like did a World War II style mobilization and we started with Israel and swept all the way through Saudi Arabia and occupied like about 8 countries and spent hundreds of billions of dollars reconstructing their economies and societies over decades, you know, maybe that might solve the issue, but that ain't going to happen. And in any case, we'd be killing many millions of people. And the only thing, I think the only path we can take is the path of diplomacy, the path of peace, the path of development, the path of income and wealth redistribution. And these are all things that I think a lot of people in the climate justice movement get, right? You cannot address climate change without addressing the huge gulf of inequality. You know, you can't talk about, like, you know, why is it that so many ecosystems are being wiped out, so many species are being wiped out? Why do we have this kind of, like, destructive fossil fuel-led development? moment. It's because of a very a highly unequal capitalist system of class power, of class warfare, and we need to have real redistribution, which I think a lot of people would be saying on the streets of Paris, that you're not going to really fundamentally address the problems of climate change. Maybe we can cut back the carbon, but you're not going to address the ecological crises without addressing the development and human and social crises. But that is going to be pushed off the table because it goes against the capitalist security state agenda.
So you had just recently written an article for Telesur that titled "What Became of the of Occupy Wall Street," and actually I can't remember whether it's in that article or in a post that you just did the other day about one of the successful offshoots of the Occupy movement was the Black Lives Matter. And while you were just speaking, it also reminded me that the climate justice movement seems like mm-hmm. a similar parallel movement.
Yeah. I mean, the climate justice movement clearly precedes it. I think one of the most – so Occupy Wall Street really shifted the national debate, right? Before that, it was all about austerity, cutting the federal debt, the annual budget deficit. Then it became, no, the real issue here is inequality. And so that was very much a positive outcome. Another positive outcome I think that gets very much overlooked is we have a return to militant, nonviolent protest. We need to remember Occupy Wall Street happened both physically in the shadow of September 11th. It was just a couple of blocks away from the September 11th attacks in downtown Manhattan. And it also happened, began days after the 10th anniversary. And I live in New York, and, you know, to go through that, I mean, it was just a really ugly buildup that whole summer of Islamophobia, just really ugly right-wing protests against this, like, alleged mosque in downtown Manhattan, which was it was essentially the equivalent of a YMCA. It was a Muslim like cultural center. So Occupy really helped, I think, push us a lot of ways past September 11th. And certainly it's the wars are not over, the Islamophobia is not over, and now we're obviously going to see a resurgence of it. But after that, you know, we've seen more militant protests. Like with the climate justice movement, we've seen these strikes by teachers, the Dreamers, the immigration rights activists haven't been engaging in this militant peaceful protest. But I think Black Lives Matter is I call them, the true heir to Occupy Wall Street, because it is very much this militant protest against the state, this amorphous leadership, this savvy use of digital media and technology, also very uncompromising in a lot of ways, you know, that there's, you know, it's like just as Occupy Wall Street, many people are saying capitalism is the problem and you can't reform it away. A lot of Black Lives Matter activists are saying police are the problem and you can't reform that away.
We are talking with Arun Gupta. He is co-founder of The Independent and the Occupied Wall Street Journal, and you are one of the speakers.
Yes.
Today, later today.
Yeah, yeah. At 3 p.m., I'll be appearing with Michael Gold Wartofsky, author of The Occupiers, an excellent book, probably the best book about the Occupy Wall Street movement. He'll be doing a reading, and I'll be giving a short talk at the Elliott Bay Book Company. So please come out, and, you know, we'll talk about whatever folks want to talk about, because I'm sure what's going on in Paris is on many people's mind. And as we've been discussing here, it's very much linked to this movement of the squares, the Arab Spring, which inspired Occupy Wall Street. All these issues are closely bound together. And we have two paths forward, democracy or war. And I think I'd hope we choose democracy, that what Occupy Wall Street was all about.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us again this morning.
Thank you, Mike.